Okay, so where do we start?
Well, maybe seen as I'm the one who's helped sort of, I guess, as the supervisor overseeing this directed readings course, I just want to first of all begin by just saying thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. It was great to learn about your Manish's connections with you going back many years ago.
Yeah, it was
And
really amazing how we met.
maybe we can begin by just doing a short round of introductions, and
Yeah,
I'll start. I'm an associate professor here at University of British Columbia in the Okanagan. I grew up in the lower mainland of Vancouver, and over the years, kind of by chance, my work has focused on issues around Buddhist pilgrimage back in India, and then leading more towards the kind of politics of heritage, especially in Bodh Gaya. So much of my work over the years has focused on Bodh Gaya. In fact, that's how I met Manish in a roundabout way, and that's how he came here to UBC. So a lot of different connections coming together. So that's a little bit about me. Maybe I'll pass you on to Leslie.
Okay.
Hello, and again, thank you very much for having us. My name is Leslie Shayer. I am a PhD student at UBC Okanagan. David is one of my committee members, and I've recently had the pleasure of meeting Manish, who has been very informative. I teach mathematics and statistics at Okanagan College, and I started to incorporate mindfulness and contemplative pedagogy into my classroom to try to decrease math anxiety. So that's part of how I got into this. I know I also do have a history of using meditation as part of for well-being in my life, in parts to deal with chronic pain, which dates back into the 90s. So I've been exposed to different forms of mindfulness, and this past semester with David has truly been enlightening and informative, and I know today will be even more so. So thank you. Manish?
Sure, thank you.
And of course, you know me partially, but I'll just give a short introduction anyway. So, of course, I'm from the place where you may have visited at some point and many points. So, Bodh Gaya. And it's unfortunate for me that being from that place, but then knowing some person who is shaping my life in general is equally important. And I have personally such a deeper respect for people like you, especially like teachers who help people like me sometimes, on a journey which is not necessarily known, to us by, like by that certain, like in that certain way, which can help me to know who am I basically, from the historically connected to the place, or physically connected to the spot. So for me, like knowing you personally back in 2015, and then knowing Sakadita in general, the community, the interesting or important community, which I was totally unaware of in the first place, it gave me such a new kind of inspiration and ideas that how things are changing in the West, especially among Buddhism and among the Buddhist nuns, especially like you or Tenzin Palmo or many other such senior Western nuns. So I'm just so grateful to be here. And as always, Dr. David Gary is my supervisor and very supportive, very kind. And Leslie, to be doctor, is also very good friend of mine now. So I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm glad that you finally made it here, when Harvard didn't work out. But something else often better turns out, because we never really know what is a bad circumstance and what is a good one, because what happens later, we don't know what will come from it.
True.
Yeah. Good. And so I think you know a little bit about me. And yeah, I grew up in Southern California, got out of there as soon as I could. Graduated from UCLA, did a little bit of graduate work at USC in education, and then I went to Nepal. I had heard a Dharma, a Buddhist course in the US, and it really struck me. So I went to Nepal, ordained in 1977, and then took the full ordination in 1986. Lived internationally for a number of years, and then wound up coming back to the U.S., which I never thought I would do, and now live at Shravasti Abbey, which is not so far from, you just go south, and you can come visit us after COVID.
We would love to do that. We'd love to make the trip. It'd be great.
Please do. Okay.
So we have a, you know, I know we sent some sort of preliminary questions, but I felt like we needed to kind of have a few more conversations around that. But so we've developed a few questions, if you don't mind us asking them, that I think relate, of course, to your experience and some of the things about mindfulness we've been discussing, and would love to hear your opinion. So maybe I'll pass it on to Manish first. I had the first question.
Okay, go ahead, Manish.
Like, I'm personally very inspired by you and your work. But again, my only personally, I wanted to like learn more about your early career, and then how did you make this transition towards, you know, leaning towards Dharma? What really struck you? Like, what really brought you to Dharma? That's like, you know, and that's like one of the important questions for me, especially after giving all your diverse background in history and education, then you move towards a total different, you know, like life actually. So,
yeah. My parents asked that same question. It's like, you weren't supposed to turn out this way. You were supposed to turn out a totally different way. Basically, since I was young, I always wondered about the meaning of life. And especially I grew up, you know, in the Vietnam era. And, you know, things did not make sense. They were telling us that we have to fight and kill people so that we can all live in peace. I didn't buy that. You know, there was a renewed racial violence in the country, some of it not that far from where we lived. And, you know, I wondered, why do people judge other people on the basis of color of their body, and the basis of their religion, the basis of their sex? And so I always had these questions, and, you know, I explored various religions when I was younger, but the idea of a God, of a theistic God, although it makes sense to many people and it helps many people, it didn't make any sense to me at all. Yeah. So by the time I went to college, I had become agnostic, and especially because I studied history, and every generation in Europe, people are killing each other in the name of God. So I said, who needs religion if all human beings do is kill each other for it? So I grew up in the 60s and 70s. You can elaborate on what I did, you know, what everybody else did. And then I worked in a special kind of classroom, you know, one of those avant-garde schools, you know, who are trying open classrooms, because I didn't know what the meaning of life was. I mean, I knew it had something to do with helping people, but I didn't know what. And education seemed like a good way, you know, to help. So I started out in education, and then I worked for a year and then sold whatever I could sell and went traveling, because I wanted to really experience life rather than read about it. I was quite tired of reading about yeah, about life and writing about life, but never reading the people, never meeting the people that I was studying. So I traveled for a year and a half in Eastern and Western Europe, North Africa. In those days, you could go overland from Europe to India, Nepal. So I did that. I was in Israel for a while, came back and worked again. I got my own classroom, my teaching credential, and I was working my own classroom. And still those questions were in my mind. And the summer of that summer after my first year with my own classroom, there was a retreat, you know, outside of LA was where I was living. And it was led by two Tibetan monks. So I went and I had signed up for 2 weeks. I wound up staying 3 weeks. I did a retreat after that. And the teachings really hit me very strongly. So what was it that hit me? When they explained that the cause of our happiness and our suffering laid in our own consciousness, in our own mind, you know? And I began to really look at my own mind and study my mind and watch the kind of thoughts. And I was always very in touch with my emotions, but watching the thoughts and assumptions that laid behind the emotions. And, you know, I had thought I was a pretty good person, but when I really looked, I saw there was a lot of many, many disturbing emotions. And my ethical conduct really wasn't that good. You know, I was always very judgmental of all the corrupt politicians. But when I lied, it was actually for somebody's benefit. So, you know, there was a lot of hypocrisy in the way I was thinking. So instead of going back to my classroom, I quit my job and I went to Nepal and then India. Yeah, so it was really the study of the mind and the application of that to my own experience and seeing how, yes, indeed, you know, attachment, anger, ignorance cause suffering, and my selfishness, my self-concern, you know, it was, you know, what the kind of person I wanted to be wasn't the kind of person I was. Yeah. And I knew I had to get my values, my ethical conduct aligned. And I need to work on my own mind and free it from these afflictions, the mental afflictions. But also, I think, because I was looking, you know, what's the meaning of life? Buddhism really presented a meaning that went beyond this lifetime. Because, you know, I always thought, what's the meaning of life? Is it just to basically duplicate my parents' life? You know, grow up, get married, have kids, get a job, advance, get more money, do the same thing, and then die at the end. And what's the purpose of all that in the long term? Yeah. So when Buddhism talked about rebirth, that really said, oh, now it makes sense, you know, and that we're trapped in samsara due to our ignorance, and that there is a way out by developing wisdom, and that you can use that wisdom to benefit sentient beings when you develop compassion and bodhicitta, the altruistic intention. Then I said, that is something worthwhile to do in my life. You know, there's no reason for me to repeat my parents' life and any other kind of life. You know, I mean, you always wind up dead at the end. So, you know, the Buddhist view of rebirth and of being able to really free sentient beings from samsara, it just made so much sense, and it gave meaning and purpose. So, and I also felt very strongly that if I disregarded this, I would regret it later on. And I never wanted to, I don't want to die with regret. So, yeah, so I decided to ordain and kind of make the Dharma the centerpiece of my life. And yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Just to add on quick, who ordained you, by the way? Who was your teacher? Like, who was your preceptor?
Okay, my preceptor was Khyabje Ling Rinpoche. His previous life, he's now in his mid-30s, but his previous life was my preceptor. And his previous life was also the senior tutor for His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
Okay.
But he wasn't my first teacher. My first teachers were Lama Thubten Yeshe and Zopa Rinpoche. Oh. They were my very first teachers.
Thank you. That's important to know the lineage and the history, because that's...
Yes. I think it is important to know, you know, who somebody's teacher is. I always ask people that because, it tells you something about the person.
I agree. Lineages are so important. And that leads me to the next question on our list of questions. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the concept of lineage has been really brought to the forefront for me over this past semester. So it's nice to start to really connect the pieces to see where everyone or everything comes from. But you've played an important role in reestablishing the Bhikshuni lineage of Buddhist nuns. Could you discuss the role of women like yourself in shaping Western Buddhism and perhaps in Asia as well?
Well, first of all, I wonder if there is Western Buddhism, because there's many different lineages and teachings from many different Buddhist traditions that have come to the West. And I don't think that they're one Western Buddhism. I think there's many different lineages and practices and traditions here. Having said that, how have the role of women you wanted? Well, it's like in most religions, okay? The men run the show and the women are the majority of the people. True or not true? Yeah. So that's it. What I found, you know, because I lived in India for quite a while, and I had never thought of Buddhism as being patriarchal. But I saw that when I came back to the West, I had lost a lot of my self-confidence. And it wasn't because people told me so many things, but it was just living in that environment where, as a woman, you automatically went for the back to sit down. Yeah. And the models that I had were the Tibetan nuns. They weren't fully ordained Bhikshunis because they don't have the lineage. And they were so shy. Oh my goodness. This was back in the 70s. So they were so shy. Like this. They never asked questions during teachings. They were so sweet and humble. And, you know, I'm an American woman and I had a career, and that stereotype of a sweet Tibetan nun, I tried to be like that and it didn't work. It absolutely didn't work. Okay. So I had to learn to, you know, be myself, and I'm from a certain culture. But I've lived in Asia a long time now, so I don't really feel so Western. Yeah. When I'm in the West, I feel like I'm part Asian. When I'm in Asia, I feel like I'm part Western. So it doesn't really matter. I'm not really big on identity politics, although the rest of the world at least the rest of this country is really into identity politics. So at the beginning, you know, what I just tried to fit in according to what you were supposed to do. And it was quite evident too that as a Westerner, I was never really going to be part of the Tibetan Buddhist establishment. So that, you know, that was kind of painful to feel, you know, excluded from the establishment of, you know, because they were Tibetan Buddhists and they were monks. That's, you know, the basic establishment. But what I've subsequently discovered over the years is because I'm a woman, because I'm a Westerner, I can do things that the Tibetan nuns cannot do. Like I went to Taiwan and I took the full ordination. I became a bhikshuni. The Tibetan nuns cannot do that. You know, I mean, they could go, but they need to really live within Tibetan society. And if they went to Taiwan to do that, it wouldn't be accepted within Tibetan society. But for me, I could go and do that, then come back to the US, establish a monastery here, and then here in our monastery, we're gender equal. Yeah. And so we go in ordination order. It doesn't matter if you're male or female. And, you know, so different things we've been able to change like that because we're in the West. And our Tibetan teachers come and they see a group of people practicing well and they're happy. And so, you know, they look at that, they're happy, they don't say much. We don't, you know, they know that we're bhikshunis, but we don't make a big deal about it. But it, you know, hopefully it makes some kind of impression on them. And, you know, hopefully after some years, it will influence what they're doing. But I really saw, you know, the Tibetan religious establishment, it's theirs, you know, and it's not for me to go in and tell them that they need to change. Okay. It would be like somebody coming into the US and telling us that we're doing everything all wrong and we have to change. And, you know, and they live in, I don't know, some other country. Nobody would, they'd say, what? You're not part of us. What are you making this comment on? Based on, okay? So, yeah, so in terms of the bhikshuni issue, it's still a work in progress. The Tibetan nuns are, you know, there's a few who have taken bhikshuni, but not very many. And the ones who have taken it aren't really in a situation to do the monastic rites. Yeah, because they go back to their nunneries and none of their other, the nuns are bhikshunis, you know, so they can't really do the bhikshuni rites because they have to fit in with the people in their own nunneries. Okay. And their teachers, many of the teachers are male, and the monks say you don't need to take the higher ordination. You already have bodhisattva and tantric vows. So, and anyway, it's too hard for you to keep. So, yeah, so then they don't have that aspiration from their side, which is sad as far as I'm concerned. But you have to wait for things to evolve, you know. Yeah. So I think in the West, what we do is we just live our life, show our example. You know, if they ask us about it, the Tibetan nuns will certainly talk about it. But we're not going to, you know, at least I'm not going to push anything. Some of my other fellow bhikshunis, Western bhikshunis, have pushed, and it doesn't work out well.
That's really, really interesting. Thank you. So I'm going to ask a follow-up question that kind of brings you back to India and Nepal again.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things I've been interested in for many years is learning more about Buddhist pilgrimage and the role of many of the Buddhist sacred sites in North India and Nepal which have gone through considerable changes, as I'm sure you've seen over the years. So I was wondering if maybe I could just ask you, from your experience, what do you see pilgrimage as an important part of Buddhist practice? And what has been your experience with pilgrimage and the changes you've seen in places like Bodh Gaya, Lumbini, and so forth?
Yeah. Well, I haven't been on pilgrimage in a long time. Mine was mostly in the last time I went on pilgrimage was in the 90s. Okay, so things have changed a lot since then. Although I was in Bodh Gaya sometime after that, and it was very, very different, but that already has been some years. My personal experience with pilgrimage is I really liked it, you know, both in India, and I did some pilgrimage in Tibet in 1986. And it's inspiring. The pilgrimage isn't just being at the holy sites. It's what's going on in your mind as you encounter all the travel difficulties, all the dust and the dirt, and you get sick, and you know, your travel plans are delayed, and the whole kit and caboodle, that is part of the pilgrimage experience. You know, it's not just sitting under the Bodhi tree and feeling holy. It's trying to work with your mind as you're, you know, going through all these things. So I think that's quite valuable. In terms of what's happened to the places, I mean, obviously they become more touristy and so on. So that brings more people there. And in a way it's good. It plants good seeds in people's minds. It could make them interested in the Dharma. In another way, it's not so nice for the people who are really earnest, who want to practice when they're in those places. A couple of years ago, I was teaching in Indonesia, and you know, we went to the, I'm not sure if you're familiar with, well, we had been to Borobudur, my first visit to Indonesia, no, second visit to Indonesia. And then a later one, we were on Sumatra in the places where Atisha had lived and where he had met Serlingpa. And because it's a Muslim country, they didn't want to do a lot to make the Buddhist sites into tourist things. They didn't want to emphasize them because they're a Muslim country. So when we went to the places outside of, what's the name of it? Jambi. Yeah, when we went to Jambi, then, I mean, it wasn't touristy at all. And half of the thing, you know, the buildings were still under the ground. They hadn't been excavated. And we could walk from one site to the other, just as, you know, I'm sure Atisha did in the middle of the jungle on a hot day, sweating gallons. And, you know, and you got a sense of, you know, what, how people lived in that times and what it was like. You could really imagine it, even though the buildings were not reconstructed, you know? So I really enjoyed that because there was something very grounding about it. And, you know, nobody was selling us trinkets or things like that. We could have used a chai shop, but there wasn't one. So is it an important part of your practice? I think that really depends on the person. Yeah, somebody was talking to Milarepa, the what was it, 14th century Buddhist sage, 13th, 14th Buddhist sage, and he, you know, asked him about, you know, going on pilgrimage. And he said, you need to do pilgrimage, you know, through your body. And, you know, he was a tantric practitioner, and, you know, locate the different chakras and energies in your body. And, you know, that's the best kind of pilgrimage to do. So, so I think it really depends on the person.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Over to you, Manish.
Just for the question of pilgrimage and, you know, this ordination, the previous question which Leslie has raised, I'm just curious to know that, were you there in Bodh Gaya when this bhikkhuni ordination took place by Sakadita? Because they did that thing in 1987, somewhere 88, probably.
It was in, what year was it in?
Somewhere.
No, Sakyadita never gave an ordination.
Probably more like an independent ordination then. The bhikkhuni ordination took place in Bodh Gaya probably.
Now, there was a very big one in, what year was it? Because I was there. I'm trying to remember what year it was.
88 people got ordained.
Yes, yeah, okay. Yeah. So there had been some in 86, I can think a couple of years before, there had been some Koreans who had done some kind of bhikshuni ordination. It wasn't in Bodh Gaya, but what happened there is a little bit fuzzy. Nobody seems to have clear details about that. The one in 88 was organized by a Chinese master from Foquan Shan. Okay. So they had the full complement of bhikshus, full complement of bhikshunis, and they asked people from other traditions. So Venerable Lekche Somo and I were both invited to be part of the bhikshuni sangha that was giving the ordination. And then in the bhikshu sangha, they had, I think, one, maybe two Tibetan monks. They had several Theravada monks. And, you know, it was very nice, you know, because they really wanted to jumpstart everything. Yeah. So what do you want to know about that?
That's also like, I feel like that's probably the inception of Sakyadita in general, because that's when the Sakyadita, the unification, like unification of, you know, bhikkhuni lineage and, you know, like all your like three premier bhikkhunis, like you, Karma Lekche, Venerable Karma Lekche, and Venerable Tenzin Palmo, like all these leading figures as like came together, and then including Venerable Dhammanandaji from Thailand. So you all came together and like, okay, let's do it.
Okay, that was the founding of Sakyadita. That was in 86.
Okay.
And that was a conference that was organized by Venerable Lekche and then this one Theravada nun, her name is slipping my mind right now.
From Thailand or from?
No, because Venerable Dhammananda was not ordained at that time.
Oh, okay.
The woman who was German?
Ayakema.
Okay. Yeah. So it's Lekche Ayakema, and I think there was somebody else involved in organizing it. I attended it. But that was the founding of Sakyadita. That was in 86, after one of His Holiness's teachings.
Wow, okay, no, great. Thank you for clarifying, because now Sakyadita has a place in Bodh Gaya. Now they got a center.
Really?
Yeah, they got a piece of land and they are like, you know, developing it. It's a women, you know, center over there in the other side of the river, crossing the river. So next time, if you come to Bodh Gaya, please, I'll make you visit there.
Okay. If I come to Bodh Gaya, you're going to have to,
I'll be the one who will be taking
Okay, time. Good.
Yeah. So, yeah, thank you for clarifying that. And like just moving forward on this, and looks like now building upon these questions, and because pilgrimage does generate certain amount of bodhicitta, as we say, you know, in Buddhist text or Buddhist language, right? And bodhicitta actually brings us close to the deeper sense of practice, which means that we wanted to meditate more, we want to contemplate more, we want to go in contact of a teacher. And this is where the mindfulness part becomes very dominant. So my question is more about like how do you feel about the secular mindfulness movement that in the West that it's kind of, you know, formulating the like these days now? And has it changed the way that you engage, you know, within the community, you engage the members within the community? Or has it brought more members within the community, like within this, you know, especially in your case, like, you know, within the Shravasti Abbey or, you know, within that certain context?
So if I just talk about my particular case and maybe Tibetan Buddhism more broadly, and I think Chinese Buddhism too would fit into what I'm saying. And probably the monastic branch of Theravada is secular mindfulness and Buddhist mindfulness are two different things. Okay, they're two different things and they should not be confused. Secular mindfulness started out, I think, more from the lay aspect of the Theravada, you know. There were people who, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein, you know, they had gone to, I think, Burma and Thailand very early on. They did Vipassana meditation and they learned the Dharma, but when they brought it back, they just taught the meditation technique of Vipassana. They did not couch it in the Eightfold Noble Path, the Four Noble Truths, the Three Higher Trainings, nothing. It was just that technique. And as far as I understand, the secular mindfulness came out of that, okay? And so secular mindfulness, you know, it had its roots long ago in Buddhism, but it's very, very different, okay? The technique is different, the motivation is different, the context is different, the result is different, okay? So it's very different. So if I start to go through what the differences are, okay? So first of all, the motivation, yeah? In Buddhist practice, your motivation is either to attain liberation from samsara, to attain nirvana, or to attain full Buddhahood. So your motivation is to really purify your mind completely, overcome all the mental afflictions and the ignorance, and become a liberated being who is no longer trapped in the cycle of existence. Yeah, that's for the ones who aim for arhatship. The ones who aim to become Buddhas, they want to develop the bodhicitta, which is the aspiration to become fully awakened in order to best benefit all living beings, you know, and then to be able to manifest many bodies and be able to teach and guide others to liberation. Okay, so that's your motivation if you're a Buddhist practitioner. Yeah. Yeah. And for a secular practitioner, the motivation is basically to feel better. So it's entirely about this life and to calm your stress in this life, to make you more peaceful and calm this life. So there's no talk of future lives, no talk of liberation, nothing like that. Okay, and so this shows there's also a difference in the context, because In Buddhism, you know, the whole context is we are, you know, beings who have the dukkha, the unsatisfactory experiences that come from circling in samsara due to our ignorance, anger, and attachment. Yeah. Secular mindfulness, what is the context in which you practice mindfulness? I don't know. Maybe it's going to your job. Maybe it's living in your family, but there's no spiritual context at all, okay? The context in Buddhism is very much, you know, if you're going to practice mindfulness among all the other practices you do, you have to do it in the context of ethical conduct, yeah? You have to do it in the context of compassion, Yeah. In other words, it's a spiritual practice, and it has to be shown in your life through your ethical conduct. In secular mindfulness, there's no talk of ethical conduct. There's no talk of compassion. Yeah. You just sit down and watch your mind. That's it. Yeah. And so you can be mindful of your anger and how much you want to retaliate against somebody who harmed you. You can be mindful of everything you're craving. A Buddhist practitioner would never do that. You know, if that kind of thoughts came up, then you apply the antidote and you don't follow those thoughts, okay? Then the technique is also very different, okay? In Buddhist mindfulness practice, you have the four establishments of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, of feelings, the mind, and phenomena. And here, your mindfulness isn't just observing them. It's having a penetrative, probing mind that is trying to understand what exactly is this body? Yeah. What are my feelings? How does my body relate to the feelings? How do the feelings produce, you know, happy feeling produce attachment? Unhappy feeling produce anger. Neutral feeling produce ignorance or confusion. You know, how do these things relate? You know, it's a whole study of the body and mind. And the purpose of doing those four establishments of mindfulness is to see that you know the body and mind so well, and you see that there is no self within that body and mind. Yeah, there is no concrete self, no inherently existent self, independent self, because it's the grasping, the ignorance that grasps at that kind of self that is at the root of our whole problem in samsara, the root of all of our dukkha, okay? So that practice is really geared towards wisdom. So mindfulness isn't just watching your mind. It's studying these things, seeing the relationship. It's bringing in wisdom. It's examining, do how these things appear to me, is that really the way they exist, okay? Secular mindfulness, there's none of that. None of that. Okay. Buddhist practice, mindfulness is one part of your practice. There's so many other practices you do. Yeah. Because our mind is something very complex. One practice alone is not going to bring you to liberation. So there's many practices we do, many types of meditation that we do, you know. We also have to study and reflect on the teachings before we meditate on them. Now, so that's, you know, in Buddhist practice. In secular mindfulness, there's none of that. Yeah. So also Buddhist, you know, if you're practicing Buddhism, you're doing it as a spiritual practice. Secular mindfulness is not a spiritual practice. Yeah, the aim is to make you feel better, you know, which is fine, but don't confuse it with Buddhism and what the purpose of Buddhist practice is. Okay, so they're quite different. Yeah, like I said, in Buddhist practice, you do so many other things because you're really trying to completely transform your mind, you know, clean it up. In secular mindfulness, now it's really gone towards entertainment. Yeah, and you know, now you do mindfulness listening to music in the background, and you do mindfulness watching your screen and pretty shapes and calming images on your screen. So it's not meditation at all. You're using your senses, not your mental consciousness. So, you know, it helps people. That's fine. It helps people. But it's not Buddhist mindfulness, and it's not a spiritual practice. Okay? And I think that gets very confused. One of my friends in Singapore, she's a Buddhist, and she also teaches secular mindfulness. And we were discussing it one time, and she agreed that it's very important to separate the two, because in Singapore, you have Muslims, you have Buddhists, you have Taoists, you have Christians. If you say this is Buddhism, then the other religions won't come. So she actually says secular mindfulness should be taught as a secular thing because it's open to everybody. You don't have to have certain religious beliefs. Okay. But Buddhism is something much more than that. Okay. So, yeah. Also, I don't know if people know, but secular mindfulness, it's the, you know, it just came about a few years ago. It's like somehow the West discovered it. It's the latest craze, you know. I mean, a few decades ago, yoga was the greatest craze. And that got changed from a spiritual practice. In India, it's a spiritual practice. Here, it became exercise, a form of exercise, okay? Yeah, mindfulness, you know, part of Buddhism came here, and now it's become, you know, the new relaxation. And I was looking at one of the questions you asked. I didn't understand what the question was, neoliberalism and, you know, da, 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 da. So I asked Venerable Thompson, who's sitting beside me, who told me about Venerable Thompson. And she told me the question, what it means in English. So I think it's really a interesting issue, you know, because when it's taught in banks, it's taught, you know, to sports teams, it's taught all over. And the purpose is to make you better at what your job is. And I was reading one article and, you know, they were saying these people are actually turning inwards and, you know, they're losing, they don't care about society. They're not talking about the structural issues in society that cause suffering. They're just concerned with their own suffering and calming it. And there is truth to that. Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely truth to that. I don't think that my idea is if you're really doing a spiritual practice, part of your spiritual practice is going to be social engagement, and you're going to care about the society you live in. So if you can make structural changes, if you can contribute to the benefit of others, then of course, motivated by compassion, motivated by bodhicitta, you definitely need to do that. Okay, that reaching out to others is part of your spiritual practice. It's not just sitting on your meditation cushion. Okay, but it seems like the mindfulness has gotten a little bit in that direction of, you know, it's going to make you be a better cog in the wheel of capitalism. Yeah. So what to do about that? I don't know. So mindfulness now is the latest, you know, it's the biggest fad like yoga was before. I think the next biggest fad is going to be compassion. And the West will take that and they will change it into feel good and they'll change it into attachment, you know. They'll change the Buddhist idea of love and compassion, which is nothing like what you hear about in the radio and see in the movies. And the West will make it like that, you know. Another big difference between the two is in Buddhism, hopefully, you're not paying for anything. Some centers charge, you know, but mostly Buddhist organizations, everything is freely offered. And it creates an economy of generosity whereby people, because they've received something from the Dharma and from the organization, they want to give back because they know the monastics need to eat and the temple needs to pay for electricity. And, you know, so everybody gives according to their ability, and there isn't any charge. So nobody's eliminated. Nobody's prevented from getting the Dharma because they don't have money. Secular mindfulness, especially, you know, you can buy an app, you know, $99.99 for three lessons. But if you get a month-long practice, it'll be $999.99, but a special discount for you, you know, and if you get 3 months, it'll, you know, we'll really give you a better discount. Yeah, that adds a whole other dimension to it. You know, you become a customer paying for a service. When you're a customer paying for a service, you can demand that that service does what you want, or else you don't buy their product. If people do that in Buddhism, then Buddhist teachers are going to start changing the Dharma to make it sound nicer to people's minds. And that's going to corrupt the Dharma and degenerate the Dharma. Yeah. And that is harmful. You know, harmful for the Dharma, harmful for all sentient beings. Okay, so that has to be avoided. So, you know, when economy and you make your living off of teaching mindfulness, yeah, I mean, I look at some of the mindfulness teachers and they have to decide where are they going to go according, even if they do it for dana, for on donation, where are they going to go so they get the most donations? Yeah, because your whole life is like that, you know? And then they have families. And so, you know, you need a lot of donations because your kids want designer shoes and they need to go to summer camp. And, you know, your spouse wants to go to Cancun to be near Ted Cruz. And, you know, It devolves into that kind of thing. Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, and then the technique. Well, so I was saying the technique, you know, we have the four foundations of mindfulness or four establishments of mindfulness in Buddhism. But the technique in secular is, you know, you just sit there, maybe you watch your breath, you watch your mind. You look at the beautiful images, you hear the music, you relax. Yeah. Then maybe you go on some kind of dating app and try and find somebody else who, you know, does mindfulness like you do. Yeah. So, yeah. So just a little story. This happened just a couple of months ago, wasn't it? I was asked to do an interview for some kind of wellness magazine. Do you remember the name?
Well and Good.
Well and Good. Okay. Well, I had never heard of it before. But anyway, they wanted to interview me on what I thought about mindfulness. So I told them. Okay. Again, they sent me the article because they had interviewed other people, some of the secular mindfulness teachers. You know, and I had said in my interview, I said, secular mindfulness is fine as long as it's really clear to people what it is and what it can do and that it's different than Buddhism. And I said, if it makes people relax and it makes them less stressed, that's good. You know, that's fine. And but what did they print in the magazine? They said that, but they didn't give what I had just told you about the difference between Buddhism and secular mindfulness, and that secular mindfulness isn't a spiritual practice and that it's relaxation. They didn't print that. So I wrote to the person who interviewed me, and she said actually she had put a whole paragraph, you know, in the article about that, because she wanted to give the balanced view. But her editor took that paragraph out. So it seems like the editor's idea was to give me as a Buddhist nun my stamp of approval on secular mindfulness, which wasn't at all how I was trying to do the article, you know, the interview. It wasn't what I said at all.
So. Thank you. That was wonderful, Venerable. That was so beautiful. And I feel like you covered part of the, you know, like the bigger picture that even as a, you know, as a student of Buddhist studies or Buddhism, I didn't know much in depth. So thank you for enlightening us. That was so wonderful for me personally. I learned a lot.
Good. So. Good. And, you know, if you could really learn like the four establishments of mindfulness, it's a fantastic practice. It's really, you know, it really gets you to think quite deeply about things. Yeah, and all the other things the Buddha taught. He didn't teach just mindfulness.
Thank you, Venerable. As Manish said, I also learned a lot, and you answered my question as well, and then some. I just have one quick follow-up. Do you feel that the secular mindfulness movement has brought Buddhism to light more in your area? Do you think you have more community members because people are, have you lost some in consequence?
No, I don't think, no, we haven't gained any, we haven't lost any. You know, some people say, well, secular mindfulness may be a lead-in to Buddhism, but I, you know, and that sounds good theoretically, I haven't experienced that with the people I work with. Nobody said, oh, I started out, you know, doing that, and then I came to Buddhism.
Go ahead. I was just acknowledging and saying thank you, so please continue. My apologies.
I think, you know, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who started the, mindfulness-based
stress reduction,
yeah. So I met him many, many years ago when he came to Dharamsala and he explained to what His Holiness, what he was doing. And he's really nice and he's very sincere. And at that time when I met him, it was something new and it was exciting for the result. And now, like all things, it's, you know, now there's a program and you can get certified and have a certificate and teach it and all. But for people who have chronic pain, it was really working very, very well. Yeah. But again, that's good for the people with chronic pain, but that doesn't mean that they're doing Buddhist mindfulness. Yeah.
Do you have a follow-up question, Leslie, or do we want to, I know I'm also very conscious of time, so if you have time for a couple more questions, we have some, but if not, we're also happy to.
Hey, if you, yeah, for a couple more questions, I have time.
Yeah.
I was just going to pass it to you, David, because Venerable answered so much and with such depth and richness. So it's all yours.
Okay, well, maybe we have just a few kind of, I think because your response to that last question kind of answered several of them. So we just have a few things. Maybe I'll ask the last question I had, which was, you know, from your experience, can you tell us a bit more about the values and benefits of monasticism in the early 21st century? And maybe just tell us a bit more about who's drawn to the monastic life at Sravasti Abbey. And how do maybe the commitments and expectations of monastic life differs from maybe lay Buddhist practitioners in the U.S.?
Oh, boy. I could talk about that for a month. yeah, I do. Yes. She's reminding me of a practice we have, usually a program. A program we have in the summer called Exploring Monastic Life for people who are interested in ordination. And she was saying, yeah, we talk about that in that program. The importance of monastic life, I think for an individual, it helps you really kind of, you get your life in shape. You stop being a jerk, you know, as I put it in colloquial language, you know, you get your ethical conduct straight. You know, you have a purpose. You know what your practice is. You know what you're trying to do. You're not confused about, you know, well, at the beginning, when you're a baby monastic, you're very confused. But after, when you practice more, then you get clearer, you become much more settled, and you know what your life is about. So I think monasticism, so on an individual level, you know, it's very good for if your aim in life is you want liberation or full awakening, monasticism, I think, is the best way to go. Not everybody is suitable for, not everybody wants to become monastics, not everybody can. So lay practice is fine. You can be an excellent lay practitioner, and there are many of those. But I know for me personally, it was something that I think was the best decision I ever made in my life to do this. I think it's important in the West, because, and in all countries, because I think monastics, Buddhist, Catholic, you know, doesn't matter, they act as the conscience of society. You know, because our values and our way of life are a bit different. So people kind of look at you and they say, oh, there's somebody, they don't have a family, they don't have sex, but they're happy. How is that possible? There's, you know, somebody else, they don't have a car, they don't have a second home. They don't even have any hair. They have one change of clothes, you know, but no makeup, no jewelry. They don't go to the disco. They don't go to the bar. They don't drink. They're vegetarian. I mean, these people are like, oh, what an ascetic trip. You know, these people must be suffering. But then they meet the people and, you know, we're happy. And then they start to go, huh, how can they be happy with those things? Maybe I don't need all those things. Yeah, maybe consumerism isn't the way to live my life. You know, that thought comes in. Yeah, we recycle things. We don't go driving, you know, just to go driving. We, you know, run a lot of errands at the same time. Yeah. And people say, oh, why do they do that? Oh, less carbon imprint on the planet. Maybe I don't need to go to the grocery store every day to get exactly what I feel like eating. Maybe I can put all my errands together and make one trip. Okay. So, or maybe, you know, people come here, it's like, oh, you mean I can recycle too? It's not that hard. So, you know, yeah, and just our attitude for equality for all people, nonviolence. Yeah, it fits very much with the current social movements in the US, I think in Canada too. Yeah. So you know, it acts as, yeah, like a conscience to society, and gets people to think, you know, well, how come these people are happy, but they don't have what I have? Yeah. So in that way, I think it benefits society, you know, and we can also give very good reasons for equality and good reasons for, you know, taking care of climate change and so on. That doesn't mean that you have to be a progressive to be a Buddhist, but it just happens that many Buddhists are progressive, but some are Republicans. Yeah. We have one young man. Oh, he's a virulent Republican because his family is. So but I think he's beginning to question stuff.
Thank you very much.
And I think also the presence of a monastic community, you can do things as a community that you can't do as one individual who's ordained. When you have a community, then people know, oh, there's a place where people are actively cultivating love and compassion and wisdom. You know, maybe I can't do that, but there are people who are doing that. So it gives me hope in the planet. And other people say, well, I want to learn to do what those people are doing. So they know there's a place that they can come and do that. And we get incredible letters from people who have never even been here, who listen to some of our talks and things online. And they just write and they say, thank you so much for what you're doing. It's just really helped me. So I think it has a role and a benefit. And like I said, we need lay practitioners and we need monastics, you know, and people have to make a choice according to their own disposition, their own interest.
Thank you. Manish or Leslie, do you have one final question or? Leslie?
I was going to, but Manish already unmuted, so.
No, no.
I was just going to reference, you were talking about offering some, how people were writing in because of some of your online presence. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering how new technology, like these online platforms and Zoom and all these types of things, has that impacted the spread of the Dhamma and community engagement for you?
Yes. Because we did some online streaming before, but you know, once the pandemic hit, then no, people couldn't come here. We had to close the monastery. So we started doing more things online. And it's just been amazing, the response. So many more people coming and listening to the teachings. And so we'll do retreats online with sessions and guided meditation. You know, there's somebody who comes regularly to the Abbey who started a morning and evening meditation session online, and she runs that. But we have retreats, and in the retreats, we have discussion groups where people really talk about how they engage with the Dharma, and people have really liked that, you know, because they say, I'm stuck in my home in the pandemic and I can't go out and, you know, I can't talk to my family about spiritual matters. So when I come here and I can have a retreat and then have discussions with other people who are practicing, finally, you know, I feel like, you know, there's people who understand me. So the technology has really impacted. And I know from other Buddhist groups, I think it's quite similar. People are putting many more teachings and activities and so on online.
That's wonderful. Is that something you can see continuing on after the pandemic?
I think they're going to demand that we continue that. It's added to our stress because, you know, nobody here knew how to do Zoom before. And you know, we had to get all kinds of, we had to get new computers, we had to get new cameras. People had to learn how you do Zoom and how to prevent somebody from crashing Zoom and putting pornography in the middle of your Zoom talk about, you know, the Buddha. And and then we run retreats, so people have to sit and, you know, run the whole tech part of it while other people teach, and we have guided meditations and so, you know, people have to run the tech. But so that's changed us a lot. Yeah. but we're so happy that people seem to be benefiting from what we're doing, that we're happy to do this and to provide this.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Thank you, Manish.
Yeah.
That is awesome. And by the way, since we are talking about the retreat, I noticed on the Instagram page of Sravasti Abbey that there was a retreat just finishing.
A retreat what?
You just finished the retreat at the Sravasti Abbey, yeah? And you were doing the fire like ceremony or something.
Yeah,
or
the fire pujas. Yeah, right. Yeah. Every winter we close the monastery and we do 3 months of retreat.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's usually January, February, March. So we just finished that just last week, you know, or earlier this week.
And looks like a lot of young people turn out there.
Yeah, you know, we're getting more and more young people. And we do a course for young adults every summer too, which is really fun. Yeah.
Nice. Wow, thank you. Thank you so much. That was just, you know, because I follow you on Instagram and I follow all the venerable there. So that's my virtual way of checking out.
Okay.
You know, I'm so happy just to see all the other activities, the deers.
Yeah. I'm so happy we reconnected, you know, because I often wondered, you know, what happened to you and, you know, so it looks like things turned out very good for you.
Yeah, and definitely here's the thing. I really wished you to visit India and come to Bodh Gaya once again on a pilgrimage if possible, you know, if the time goes well in the next few years and traveling goes normal. So I would be more than happy, you know, to kind of support you or look after you there when you are there at some point of time.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will accept that invitation at some point.
Yeah, please. Yeah. Then this time we have better roads, so the pilgrimage will be a little bit smoother.
Oh, okay. Not on the bus this month.
Not exactly. So we'll have a better road. I'm not sure that this time everything organized well and the comfort levels will be better, so you don't get too much of suffering.
Okay.
Well, maybe this is a good place to conclude then. I think we've taken enough of your time. And
okay, thank you.
I really want to say thank you for sharing your wisdom with us. And hopefully we can have a chance to come meet you down there in the near future.
Yes, please do. Yeah, and good, you know, wishing you everything well with your doing, with your studies and your books and your degrees and getting tenured and everything like that. Yeah, very good. Okay, take care. Okay,
thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. All the best.
Take care.